This episode sponsored by Apollo Neuro.
Having problems getting a good night's sleep? Apollo Neuro may be the help your body needs. Apollo Neuro is a wearable designed to calm your nervous system so you can fall asleep faster and sleep deeper without medication or side effects. It works by sending gentle, silent vibrations through your wrist that signal safety to your body, like a hug for your nervous system. The result? Fewer wake-ups, deeper sleep, and mornings where you actually feel rested. It's not just a sleep tracker. Apollo actively helps you regulate your body, and Smart Vibes AI automatically personalizes the experience for sleep, calm, focus, and recovery. It's scientifically backed, with clinical trial participants gaining up to 60 minutes of sleep a night. Try it risk-free for 30 days. Visit apolloneuro.com/audio and take $99 off today.
I know how intimidating beekeeping can be, especially in those first couple of years, and not knowing what you need, what to do, or where to find help can be downright scary. That's why I created the AI-assisted Beekeeping for Newbies mobile app to be right there with you as you start your beekeeping journey. Loaded up with checklists, guides, and one of my favorites, a bunch of queen bee photos to help you get better at locating them during inspections. I created this app to provide you with a single source to help jumpstart your learning and make you a better beekeeper. Go to studio.com/beekeeper. That's studio.com/beekeeper to take advantage of a limited time 20% off launch special.
Hey, everybody. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to Beekeeping for Newbies. Thank you so very much for taking the time to listen. I do appreciate you. And as always, feel free to reach out, Jeff@beekeepingfornewbies.com. Like I've mentioned before, I think about 90% of the content comes from questions and things that you folks ask. So please keep those coming, and hopefully we can get some more content out there that can be of value and use to you. First off, I want to take a second to thank everyone. We kind of hit a little bit of a milestone here on the podcast. Now, I'm sure anybody who is a professional podcaster who wakes up every day and produces a lot of content, you know, is going to hear this number and they're like, yeah, I do that every day. But we just went over 100,000 downloads a couple weeks ago, which I think is pretty cool. And I owe that all to all of you. So thank you so, so very much for taking the time to listen. And I guess the next big one will be like 1 million. So we'll see if we can get there. But, you know, honestly, I never thought that I'd have more than like 8 or 9 people listening. So the fact that we're able to save people a few bucks here and there and get a couple of tips and tricks out there, I mean, that's what it's all about for me. So I'm very happy, very excited about it. Truly blessed. So thank all of you very, very much. So getting down to the nitty gritty here, I do have a bit of a kind of a bad update here. As you might remember, I think it was the first week of April, I did some early splits. Now at my house, I've kept, you know, my honeybees at my house for several years. And you know, and my spring comes a little bit earlier. You know, I live on the coast, so having, you know, being surrounded by water, it's a little bit warmer in the wintertime, it's a little bit cooler in the summertime than it is inland. And you know, I did all these splits on the hives that are down at the apiary, which is of course, you know, well inland. I knew I was being a little aggressive. I knew it was early, but I thought, you know, it's going to be fine. You know, the temperatures had been fairly warm. We had really good weather. And I thought, you know, I'm not going to worry about it. I'll roll the dice a little bit. It's a little bit early, but we'll see what happens. So I did those splits, and this was basically, you know, a single frame with a brand new queen and across all 12. And I think it was the night after I did the split, the temperature hit about 39. The next night it was below freezing. The next night it was like right at freezing. And then we had a couple days where it was a, you know, relatively normal nighttime temp in like the, you know, low 50s or something like that. And then that next week I got hit again with one or two nights of some freezing temperatures. And I went to do my inspection and all 12 of them were dead. They had all frozen. And you know, it's one of those things where I knew better. I knew it was aggressive, but I really didn't take into consideration how much cooler that it was inland versus, you know, here where I've been at the house on the coast. So I lost all of them. So again, you know, the primary purpose for me being here is to make a lot of mistakes so that I can pass those mistakes on to all of you so that you don't make the same ones I made. So that's what happened to my splits. So for all the folks who've emailed and said, hey man, what's going on with those splits? I haven't heard anything. There you go. So shifting over to a couple of, I'm just kind of reading through my notes. I've got so many notes I've put together over the past month or two. So I think now, man, I'm just going to jump in here and go right into some questions that have come in here and also talk about some upcoming episodes. So let me hit the upcoming episodes. Now, these are kind of subject to change depending on, you know, where my notes are and what I can find and whether or not I completely have my act together. But the next episode that I'm going to be recording right after this today is, it's called, you know, Free Honeybees for All. This is relating to swarm traps. A lot of people have asked before about, you know, what is a swarm trap? How do they work? You know, when should I use them? So we're going to do an episode about that, and we'll cover those. The next episode beyond that, episode 31, is going to be what happened to my queen? So this is a common challenge, particularly in the spring, when you have queens, you know, new virgin queens being born, flying, mating flights, you know, supersedure, all kinds of things that can happen. So we're going to talk about that. There's been some requests around, you know, should I split, when to split, what do I do after I've split the colony, ways to just expand an existing colony. I'm just calling it splitting and expanding. And what to do when your interventions fail. This kind of topic came from a young lady down in Florida that I was working with earlier in the spring. And I felt so bad for her because she's been kind of killing it down there, doing a great job, having fun, and just getting really excited. She's got her kids involved and things were really going well. And then she did a split and then things started kind of falling apart. I haven't heard from her in a while, but we want to talk about that a little bit more, you know, what to do when your interventions fail. So those are kind of the next four episodes that I've got teed up. My intent is to get everything out within the next couple of days. That kind of covers a couple of upcoming episodes and things. And let's just dive into some emails and questions here. I had a question about frames. So, you know, when should you cycle out old frames and why do you do this? I would think of a frame inside of a beehive as basically kind of being like a hair on your head or like your DNA. Like having a frame has all of the history of that colony. So, and I mean that specifically from like a chemical standpoint. So if the bees are out in the environment and they're gathering things and then they make the wax that becomes the foundation or that ends up being drawn into the comb, all of the things that they gather essentially become a part of that comb. And if there is anything bad, any kind of disease or anything that is not healthy, it can also end up in the comb. So the comb itself can have a little bit of a history of the colony in it, either good or bad. Over time, it's just generally good to replace the foundation because one, it becomes really, really brittle. So just to work with it, you can press on it lightly and it'll just kind of snap and crack off. So from a management standpoint, it just, you know, you should probably replace it so it doesn't break off when you're handling it and manipulating the frames and moving things around. But the real important thing about it is really just from a hygienic standpoint to make sure that if there is anything in there, you're getting it out at least on some sort of a schedule. Now, if you have one or two hives, and this is not a lengthy process, it's not really a big deal. If you have several of them, it becomes a bit more laborious, I guess you could say. But a lot of times what people will do, they'll get on a cycle of maybe every 3 to 5 years. So let's say you had two hives and you had, you know, two deeps on each one and two mediums on each. You might do something where you're cycling out your brood frames every 3 years, or maybe you're doing one of your deeps at the 3 year point, the next one at the 4 year point. And then, you know, if you had another one, maybe at the 5th year, whatever it might be, you're basically just getting on some kind of a routine where you're cycling out the old foundation, the old drawn comb, I should say, not the foundation, but the old drawn comb, so that you get a clean start and eliminate anything that could be buried within that foundation. That is assuming that everything is healthy and everything is going great. If you have problems, if you were seeing any kind of disease, particularly now, you know, if you're dealing with foul brood, you're burning the whole thing. Make a fire in the backyard, consult with your local codes and ordinances and legal authorities. Don't just randomly burn things in places that you shouldn't, because I don't want you to get in trouble. But, you know, make sure you're following the law, but, you know, take them somewhere, burn them, dispose of them. And you, because once that hive and those components and those pieces are infected, it's not going to go away. And it's really easy to spread to your other colonies or colonies that are in the area. So you're going to burn everything. But there are other things that can come up that can be essentially almost cut out where you could cut out the foundation. You know, but as an example, if you had like a wax moth, as an example, right? The wax moth could get into the colony and could lay into a small area, lay some of the eggs, and maybe even a couple of the young larval worms, basically, that crawl through the hive. You may have a small section that's infected. You can cut that out. Again, if it's a small section, if it's large, you're better off to just destroy the whole thing. But if there's a small section, you could cut that out, toss it to the side, throw that frame in the freezer for, you know, 2 or 3 days. And then you could put that frame back into the hive and they'll redraw the comb back up. One thing with that is if you do freeze a frame, I don't know why I just thought of that song from the 80s. But anyway, if you freeze the frame and you're going to put it back into the colony, put it outside somewhere, or at least put it somewhere where it can get back to room temperature first. I mean, you don't want to drop a 30 degree frame into a 90 some degree hive. I mean, I know it's nice to think of the idea of dropping some air conditioning in there for them, but you know, putting a cool frame in there with the hot, yeah, it's probably not a good idea. I had another question that was about, like, the flow should be on. Why am I not seeing honey? So gauging the flow, it's always kind of a thing people ask me, like, hey, how do I know what's going on with, you know, in my area, and how do I know that the flow is on? So there's a few things you can do. There's different resources out there that you can look at through your, you know, local bee clubs, or there are, I think I found things online where it actually was like a chart and it showed diagrams of all the things that are in bloom in different areas, and you can kind of align the chart to a different month. But that's kind of like a Google search type of thing that you should be able to find something that talks about the forage and the browse and things that are going to be available. I shouldn't say the browse. We're not talking about like deer, but the forage that is available for the bees at different times of year. But the one thing I do is the pollen.com alerts. They're not great for a lot of detail. You know, like, they're not going to talk about every single thing that might be in bloom in your area. As an example, cotton. My bees will be on cotton here pretty soon. That, you know, cotton, I've never seen that show up in my pollen alerts, right? But they're good for letting you know, like, in the spring, for me, it's usually like late February, early March timeframe, I get those emails from them that come out. Once it hits a certain threshold of pollen, they'll email me and say, hey, pollen alert. And it's always, you know, cedar, elm, juniper, alder, those are always the ones that come up first in the very beginning of the season. So once those kick in, at least you know, okay, things are starting to bloom, and that gives you an idea. Outside of that, it's going to be very geographically specific because, I mean, I can drive 30 miles from where I am right now, and things are going to be different just because of where I am in a suburb and surrounded by water. But, I mean, the one simple thing, you know, you can kind of sit outside the hive, and you'll see them come back, and the pollen sacks are going to be loaded down, you know, with different colors of pollen. That's a pretty solid indicator. I mean, dandelion tends to come in fairly early, you know, where I am and in a lot of places. So looking for that pollen is going to kind of be the first step. Now, keep in mind, too, that that nectar that's coming in, it has to, you know, get to a certain water level or water concentration. They're going to put the nectar into the colony and store it, and then it's going to evaporate to a certain level before they say, okay, now we're going to go ahead and cap that to actually make it capped honey. So just kind of keep that in mind too, that you'll see it stored as nectar first before it becomes honey. I'm not sure if that answered the question, but if whoever emailed me about that, if that doesn't, definitely shoot me a message and we'll revisit that. Now I'm going to an email on this next one here. Okay. So the subject of the email was that it just, I can't find my queen. So they got a nuke, they put everything into their hardware, got it all squared away. Queen was in a queen cage, and they went out on the, a couple days later, the queen was outside the cage, everything was great. They did an inspection a couple days later, and they didn't find the queen, and they noticed that there were some queen cells that were in there. So now here we are, it looks like based on this email, it was probably about 4 or 5 days had gone by, and there were queen cells. Okay, so basically what happened here is new nuke. Queen was in a cage. They came back a couple days later. Queen had been released. And then during an inspection, the person who emailed me noticed that there were queen cells. So if you think about a nuke should have, and this is kind of a general rule of thumb, it's not always this way, but you should be getting, if it's a 5-frame nuke, you know, 2 frames of honey or honey and some nectar. And then the other 3 frames really should be loaded up with you know, ideally at least a full frame or two of capped brood, but the other frame might, you know, might be a mix of, you know, eggs, larvae, and some capped brood. So in this situation, when he went back and did the inspection, he could not find the queen anywhere, and he found queen cells. So what it sounds like to me is, for one reason or another, the colony didn't like that queen. And they were like, yeah, we're not going to have her. So they probably killed her and then made a queen cell from, you know, a young larva that was already there that had transitioned over during the creation of that nuc. Because most likely, you know, the other beekeeper who was running that apiary and created that nuc for this person, they probably, you know, grabbed a few frames here and there from different hives, put it all together, and then just took a newly mated queen and put her in the cage, and she was in a brand new colony. They didn't know her, right? So it makes sense to go ahead and cage her and give them a couple of days to get used to her scent. Now, this is a thing that can be debated and contested, you know, back and forth. There's a lot of people that say, look, if you've got a mated queen and she's a laying queen, because there is a difference between a mated queen and a laying queen. So if you have a laying queen that you take out of a colony and you put her into a colony that does not have a queen, that pheromone for her is at its strongest possible level because she is a laying queen. A queen that is mated but then put into a queen cage and has not been laying, after about, you know, 8, 10, 12 hours, she will significantly reduce in size. She will get smaller. And her pheromone that she's putting out is also significantly reduced because she's not actively laying. So there's a couple things we can talk about, you know, in a different area, different topic, or different time around what we can do to kind of help with that. But in this case, it sounds like she was released and they didn't feel the right vibe they needed to feel, and they probably killed her. So they went ahead and created emergency cells. The problem here, and I'm certainly not picking on this guy at all, right? Because I think what he was trying to do was a pretty sound thing. He said, oh gosh, I've got swarm cells here. I better get rid of them. Unfortunately, and again, when you're a new beekeeper, there's a lot of things coming at you, and it's hard to know, you know, what's right or wrong at any given point in time. But I think that what he did was probably right for, you know, 90% of situations. He went ahead and killed all the queen cells and removed them. Because he was thinking, oh, you know, for some reason, maybe they're overcrowded, and, you know, I don't want them to swarm, so I'm going to get rid of them. I think the problem is that they had already killed the queen, and that was that. So I kind of made that suggestion, like, hey, look around a little bit. Since you removed the queen cells, you might be in a bind, but give it a couple more days and come back and look. He came back and looked again a couple days later. There were no eggs and no young larvae, and it sounds like they are queenless. So my suggestion to him was, you know, go back to the apiary and the business that he purchased the nuc from and see if he can get a mated queen from them that he can then reintroduce to the colony. I think that, in, you know, in a situation where they have no eggs, they have no larvae, they have no ability to create another queen, hopefully they'll be more apt to accept this other queen. Otherwise, they're going to die and they're going to be in a lot of trouble. So I haven't heard back from this gentleman in a while. I don't know what the outcome or the final resolution was on that. But hopefully he was able to get a replacement queen and get them back on track. So I had another email about feeding, like when should I feed and when should I not feed? And this is a pretty kind of contested subject. I'll tell you what I do, and I'll tell you what I've heard and what I know of other people doing. But when it's all said and done, I'll tell you, like everything else in life, there are people who just feel like there's only one way to do things, and it just has to be this way. It has to be my way. And if it's not that way, then it's just not right. That's fine. They can take that position if they want. I'm a firm believer that while there are probably 100 ways to do something, maybe 90 of them work pretty well and get the job done. You get the 90% solution. And there's probably like 8 or 10 of them that are really bad ideas, right? I don't know if that's, I'm just making up numbers. But the point I'm getting at is there's not just one way to do things. And if you put feed in a colony and they don't need it, then they won't drink it. That's it. So you're going to put some sugar syrup in. They don't drink it. I guess they don't need it. Nobody's hurt. So what I do is, this is based on Michael Palmer. I always do a 2-to-1 sugar syrup solution. and I've talked about it before, but again, we'll go through it again. Take a bucket, put a line in the bucket, fill that bucket, and it can be any size container, doesn't matter. Fill it up to that line with sugar. Put water in, mix it up. I use a cordless drill with a paint mixing paddle, and I fill it up with water, and I mix the sugar until it, you know, starts to settle down below that line, and then I fill it up with water again up to that line, and then I mix it again with that mixing paddle and just kind of go through the whole thing, mix it as best as I can. The water will go down again. Add a little more water. Basically, when you get to a point where adding water keeps you at that line and doing the mixing back and forth between mixing and adding water, the water no longer gets below that line or above that line, that's a perfect 2-to-1 combination. There's different schools of thought around, well, if you do a 1-to-1, it stimulates this. And if you do a 2-to-1, it stimulates that. What I've found is that if the bees have nectar coming in or they have sugar syrup coming in and they need space to put it in, they will draw comb. Whether it's 0.5-to-1, whether it's 10-to-1, whatever the concentration mix is, if they need space, they will draw the comb and they will make the space. I just like the idea, and then again, this isn't, it's not my original idea here, but Michael Palmer was like, hey, if you're going to give them something, why not give them something that's a higher concentration and you can just make less at one time? You're not dealing with, you know, 2 5-gallon buckets to get the same amount of sugar when you can do it in 1 single 5-gallon bucket. So that makes sense to me. I typically, if I have an existing colony in the spring, if for some reason I open the hive, that very first time that I open the hive, if they have nothing, I mean, they're at a point where they're struggling, they're weak, they've got no more food stores in there, you know, that might be a good time to consider feeding. Keep in mind that if you do still have some cooler nighttime temps, you don't really want to have, you know, frozen sugar syrup in there, but give them something, right? Something is better than nothing. But in general, you know, my colonies, I don't have to feed existing colonies in the spring. They go out, they find, you know, nectar, they find the resources they need, they ramp up really, really quickly in the spring, and, you know, it's just, it takes care of itself. I primarily feed in 2 situations. One of them is, and I'm going to go into this in detail on these upcoming episodes talking about swarming, but if you catch a swarm or you catch a swarm in a swarm trap, I will feed those. If you do a split, I will typically feed splits. And I guess the last one would be package bees. If you're doing package bees, you'll want to feed them because they have nothing. Like I said, if you're on the fence and you're like, oh God, should I feed? Should I not feed? Just feed them. Just feed them. And it's not the most nutritious thing in the world. Sugar syrup is not going to give the best nutritional value to your bees in comparison to what they would gather naturally in the environment. You know, it's kind of like, hey, I got to keep my kids alive and all I have is, you know, sweet tarts and gummy worms or whatever. Like, you know, yeah, it's not the best thing in the world for them, but it might keep them alive. Again, it's not the healthiest solution, but if, again, they will choose what's in the environment over sugar syrup. They would rather have nectar from plants and flowers and things that are out there than they would to have it from a feeder of just sugar. But when you have those rainy days, particularly in the spring, particularly with these newer colonies, and they have nothing stored up yet or minimal resources, having that sugar in there can save the day for them. So hopefully that helps a little bit on the feeding side. And again, this is something that we're going to discuss again. And as you know, listen to more and more episodes, you're probably going to hear some things over and over. I do that for 2 reasons. One, it's to kind of reinforce things. There are certain concepts and ideas that just need to be talked about over and over again, because with all the moving parts of beekeeping, it's hard to remember everything. So you'll hear some things over and over. The other part too is there are some people that just jump in for the first time at maybe episode 20. You know, maybe they haven't had a chance to go back and listen to everything from earlier on. So you might hear some things that are kind of repetitive. So hopefully it won't be too painful for you. Well, folks, I am going to wrap up this Bee Buzz episode here. I've got, like I said, I've got 5 episodes of notes right here in front of me. Like I mentioned before, I get the ideas for episodes from your feedback and the things that you all send me. So please feel free to drop me an email, jeff@beekeepingfornewbies.com. And if you have questions or you're running into some obstacles, I probably get anywhere between like 3 and 20 emails a day. And I get to talk to people all over the country and occasionally all over the world. And it's really fun. I enjoy it. It's really exciting. So please don't hesitate to reach out. And if you're hitting a roadblock or obstacles, let me know and we'll try to lend a hand. Outside of that, folks, I hope everyone is well. Stay out of trouble and we'll talk to you soon. Take care.
I know how intimidating beekeeping can be, especially in those first couple of years, and not knowing what you need, what to do, or where to find help can be downright scary. That's why I created the AI-assisted Beekeeping for Newbies mobile app to be right there with you as you start your beekeeping journey. Loaded up with checklists, guides, and one of my favorites, a bunch of queen bee photos to help you get better at locating them during inspections. I created this app to provide you with a single source to help jumpstart your learning and make you a better beekeeper. Go to studio.com/beekeeper. That's studio.com/beekeeper to take advantage of a limited time 20% off launch special.